Never in U.S. history has the nation defaulted on its credit. Most think that would be catastrophic. But there are those, like Iowa's Steve King, who have called it a false narrative. River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Representative Steve King of Iowa's 4th Congressional District has come to the fore in the current debate over the Affordable Care Act and the partial government shutdown. This hour we'll discuss King as one of a hardcore group of about two dozen Republican representatives in pursuit of the Holy Grail, the end of Obamacare. This and related developments on this Politics Day with our analysts, Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University, Bruce Nesmith of Coe College. What are your thoughts on the partial government shutdown and the looming debt ceiling default? Our discussion starts right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day, Politics Wednesday, has arrived, and we're glad to have with us Bruce Nesmith, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coe College, joining us by phone. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Ben.
Stephen Schmidt is in our AIM studio, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Stephen, good to hear talk with you again.
Hello.
Let's dive right into it because we know what is going to consume our hour, and we want our listeners to join into our conversation as well. The stalemate over the government shutdown grinds into this, its ninth day. That default on U.S. debt looming, I guess the debt date for that default at October 17th. In dueling news conferences yesterday, President Obama and Republican House Speaker John Boehner said they spoke on the phone yesterday, but neither side changed their minds about the issues causing a partial government shutdown. President Obama says House Republicans need to do their jobs.
This morning I had a chance to speak with Speaker Boehner, and I told him what I've been saying publicly, that I am happy to talk with him and other Republicans about anything, not just issues I think are important, but also issues that they think are important. But I also told him that having such a conversation, talks, negotiations, shouldn't require hanging the threats of a government shutdown or economic chaos over the heads of the American people. Think about it this way. The American people do not get to demand a ransom for doing their jobs. You don't get a chance to call your bank and say, I'm not going to pay my mortgage this month unless you throw in a new car and an Xbox. If you're in negotiations around buying somebody's house, you don't get to say, well, let's talk about the price I'm going to pay, and if you don't give me the price, then I'm going to burn down your house. That's not how negotiations work. That's not how it happens in business. It's not how it happens in private life. In the same way, members of Congress and the House Republicans in particular don't get to demand ransom in exchange for doing their jobs. And two of their very basic jobs are passing a budget and making sure that America is paying its bills. They don't also get to say, you know, unless you give me what the voters rejected in the last election, I'm going to cause a recession. That's not how it works. No American president would deal with a foreign leader like this. Most of you would not deal with either coworkers or business associates in this fashion, and we shouldn't be dealing this way here in Washington.
And Speaker Boehner says, he said this yesterday, while the conversation with the president yesterday was pleasant, he was disappointed. The president still refuses to negotiate.
So the president's position that, listen, we're not going to sit down and talk to you until you surrender is just not sustainable. It's not our system of government. When it comes to the debt limit, I agree with the president. We should pay our bills. I didn't come here to shut down the government. I certainly didn't come here to default on our debt. But when it comes to the debt limit, again, over the last 40 years, 27 times the debt limit has been used to carry significant policy changes that would, in fact, reduce spending and put us on a saner fiscal path. And President Reagan sat down with Tip O'Neill in the 1980s. President Bush in 1990, went out to Andrews Air Force Base and got into a long debate and negotiation with Democrats here in Congress. Bill Clinton went through this three times in the 1990s. President Obama and I sat down in 2011 and had a serious negotiation. And while the president today suggested that I walked away from the deal, I would have to remind him that I was in the Oval Office along with the majority leader, Eric Cantor, when we in fact had an agreement that 2 days later the president walked away from. But there was in fact another negotiation in 2011 that resulted in really the largest deficit reduction bill that we've seen here in the last 30 years. But in 2010, when Democrats controlled the Congress and President Obama was in the White House, what happened was a group of moderate Democrats in the House wouldn't agree to raise the debt limit without a negotiation. So there was a negotiation then amongst Democrats over raising the debt ceiling. The long and short of it is there's going to be a negotiation here.
Okay, John Boehner. Before that, President Obama. Dueling press conferences yesterday as this stalemate over the government shutdown grinds to its ninth day, default possibly on the $16.7 trillion U.S. debt looming on October 7th. How worried are you, River to River listeners? 1-866-780-9100. What's on your mind? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Lengthy excerpts from the dueling press conferences yesterday, Bruce and Stefan. Stefan, give us your take on the positions that are staked out here.
Well, this is not Ronald Reagan, and this is not any of those periods in the past. I mean, right now, a lot of my Democrat friends are saying, gosh, Karl Rove is a real moderate, and I wish he was still, you know, running something in Washington. This is a whole new generation of individuals who have come in and who have a very different attitude about government to begin with. I mean, if you look at Michelle Bachmann's statements, Steve King and others, they actually really don't like the federal government. They would like to shut down many of the agencies that, you know, that do a lot of good work. I mean, the Environmental Protection Agency we couldn't live without, and they would like to basically take those out. And so you've got essentially a group of highly determined outsiders who view Washington as the enemy and the government as the enemy, negotiating with Democrats who now as much as they have in the past, think that government is useful and good and ought to take a strong positive role.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the points there that John Boehner made? He listed quite a number of points in history where there have been negotiations over debt limit. Is he right?
Technically, he's right, but you know, this is not the way that you, for example, approach a major program. Such as the health care law, which is now the law and which is being implemented, that just isn't done. I mean, you wouldn't in the past come in and say, you know, George W. Bush didn't come in and say, okay, look, I want Social Security privatized, and I'm not going to sign on any legislation, any continuing resolution unless you shut down, unless you eliminate Social Security.
Okay, Bruce Nesmith, how do you weigh in on this?
Well, I think just to kind of go on with what Stefan was saying is there's two differences here. One is that there's a difference between negotiating over taxing and spending levels and having side policy issues in there. That I think it's one thing to say, you know, we can't pass a debt limit unless there's we can't support a debt limit increase unless there's substantial deficit reduction, as opposed to we're not going to go along with this unless you repeal this other law. So that's one difference. A second difference is that I think the relationships between the negotiators in the past were lower key, and I think, you know, a lot of that was done well in advance of the debt limit, whereas I think here you have a situation where the clock was kind of deliberately run out before negotiation was even begun. And I think then the third problem is that when Reagan was negotiating with O'Neill or Clinton was negotiating with Gingrich, or you name your person, that it was understood that each side could represented their side. Each person represented their side. So when Clinton negotiated the deal with Gingrich, then it was done. And it was just a matter of formality of taking it through Congress that Gingrich was able to speak for Republicans, Clinton for Democrats in ways that were authoritative. They could back up what they agreed to. And I think what's happened, despite Speaker Boehner's comments, what happened in 2011 and then what has happened a couple times already in 2013 is that John Boehner does not speak for his party. And so he agrees to something, or he indicates that he can live with something, and then a week later or 2 weeks later, it's back to, well, now I'm going to need health care repealed again or something like that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, River-to-River listeners, 1-866-780-9100, how worried are you about the partial government shutdown? Perhaps it's affected you directly. Share that with us. Or how worried are you about the possible default on the U.S. debt said to be looming on October 17th? 1-866-780-9100. Bruce Nesmith and Stefan Schmidt with us. Let's go to Zach. Zach is our first caller from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Zach.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
To your direct question on whether I'm worried, unfortunately, you have to be. Just because there's so much mistrust and so much dysfunction in Washington, you just never know what can happen. And unfortunately, that's where we're at now in our country. When you elect a politician, you expect them to focus on issues like immigration, healthcare, the economy, things that actually matter. Unfortunately, as we've seen, growing more and more so over the past few years, politicians would rather just argue about, who's winning the game, who is looking better in the eyes of the American public, who is winning on brinkmanship. And unfortunately, it makes us go through these manufactured crises instead of actually looking at issues that matter to the average American.
Mm. Zach, thank you for that point of view from Cedar Rapids. Stefan, in a recent column, I believe your column in the Des Moines Register, was it you, in your answer to how worried are you or how worried should we be, you talked about the dangers of this partial government shutdown. And maybe you could summarize the points you made in that column.
Well, we have an obligation to meet, especially our responsibilities to bondholders, to those who have extended credit to the United States by buying treasury bonds. And that is an obligation that is golden. It's not like putting off, paying your cable channel bill for a month. That obligation has to be met on an hourly basis, practically. And so if you want to play chicken with the national debt, you really are essentially setting the house on fire when that happens. And I also quote in that article George Washington, who warned us many years ago about the risks and dangers of division and essentially what partisanship. That was before there were political parties, but he could already see that conflicts and divisions could be very dangerous and that there ought to be a different way of approaching this. But our governmental system, frankly, is structured around conflict. It's structured around disagreement. And the last caller, with all due respect to him, the discussion going on in Washington is about substance. The Republicans disagree with the shape of the immigration bill that the Democrats would like to pass, and that's why we don't have an immigration bill. The Republicans disagree on policy matters with how health care should be managed in this country, and that's why they're opposed to Obamacare. So on every one of these confrontations, it is actually real disagreements about how things should be done and to what extent government should be involved and how big government should be that the conflict and confrontation occurs. And that's even true of the farm bill, which we still don't have, and the separating out of the farm bill of food stamps, where the Republicans feel the food stamp program is abused, is much, much too large and want to trim it way back, and the Democrats feel that it's a necessary safety net for a lot of people. So we can look at politics in Washington as if it were just a bunch of trivial discussions and people throwing mud at each other, but the root of it is now an actual really deep disagreement about how the government should function. And that's very, very confrontational.
House Speaker John Boehner has explained often, we've heard, why his Republican caucus is standing firm on this spending bill. He thinks there's dangers posed by the president's health care law. However, Bruce, let me ask you this, because on Sunday, Boehner went further. He said the votes are not there to pass a clean spending bill, a clean CR that would fund the government without making changes to the Affordable Care Act. And that statement goes against many other observers, both Republican and Democrat, who believe the opposite. So where do you come on that, down on that, and that idea? Are the votes there in the House if John Boehner called a vote?
They seem to be there. And by seem to be, I mean that if you assume all the Democrats will vote for a clean continuing resolution, and you count the number of Republicans who have made statements in recent weeks saying that they would support, that they would like to see a continuing resolution without conditions, that adds up to more than 218. There was a reporter for National Public Radio who I'm now going to blank on their name, but her name, it was a woman who gathered all that information. The reason why I say it seems to be is sometimes people change their mind. There was a vote recently where a moderate Republican from Pennsylvania thought he had lined up 20-some Republicans to support a certain position, and when it came to the vote, there were only two, only one other and him. So sometimes those votes can evaporate, but if we gather statements, it looks like those votes would be there.
Bruce Nesmith with us of Coe College, Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Jeff is joining us from Blockton. What's your view, Jeff?
I have two points. You know, the Congress was given the power of a purse for a reason. You know, and Harry Reid and Obama are now saying they're willing to negotiate as long as the Republicans give them what they want. Well, if the Republicans give them what they want, what is there to negotiate? You know, and President Obama was talking about that, that the people want Obamacare. The people spoke at the last election. Well, he's got a short-term memory because back in 2010 when Obamacare was passed by the Congress, yes, we can, met. Oh, no, we don't.
Okay. Jeff, thank you for those comments from Blockton. Stephen, any reaction to that?
Well, there's also a principle that's called majority rule in this country. And majority rule applies in Congress. And if, in fact, there were to be a majority, as Bruce said, in the House to get the continuing resolution out and restart the government, then you'd think that Chairman Boehner would have, or Speaker Boehner would have, the obligation to call a vote. The reason he is not willing to call for a vote in the House is because he's afraid he's going to lose that and that enough Republicans will join the Democrats and then you'll have a majority. What is astonishing and frightening is that while the Republicans accuse Obama of being a dictator and not wanting to negotiate, the truth of the matter is that the Speaker of the House is a real tyrant and can stop the majority of members of the House from moving a piece of legislation by simply not calling up a vote. That's an incredible power that, if misused, can really paralyze things. I mean, you know, the Democrats have essentially the game because they have the White House and they have the Senate. And, you know, the Republicans, under almost no scenario, could do away with Obamacare because the president would veto it even if they could get it passed, and then the Republicans wouldn't have a supermajority to override a veto. So it's a losing game, and it's a symbolic game, and it's a game to try and gain some time, and it's costing us dearly. The mortgage industry is paralyzed. The markets are jittery. Consumers are running to the bank and sticking their money in the bank and putting their credit cards in their safety deposit boxes. They're not going to go out and spend any money until these people sit down and get this all solved.
Let's talk a little bit before we have to take a break, Stefan and Bruce, about the faction that John Boehner is that seems to be wielding quite a bit of power in the House. Representative Steve King of Iowa's 4th Congressional District has come to the fore in this current debate about the Affordable Care Act, about the partial government shutdown. And he's one of this group of hardcore Republicans, about two dozen representatives pursuing the end of Obamacare. And when asked if he was willing to carry the fight over the Affordable Care Act through the deadline for raising the debt ceiling, or whether he was willing to let the U.S. default on its debt, Congressman King of Iowa said it was a false argument. Let's listen.
I don't think the credit of the United States is going to be collapsed. I think that all this talk about a default has been a lot of demagoguery, a lot of false demagoguery. We have plenty of money coming in to service the debt. When we stop servicing the debt, that would be default. We're a long, long ways from that. And I think we need to have cool heads and get to a solution. That means the president needs to come to the table. Harry Reid needs to come to the table. We're looking for solutions. We're having meetings discussing that. But if the other side refuses to negotiate, then there's really nothing that can be done except to continue to offer to negotiate. And we'll be in this town until this is resolved. I don't think anybody's going home here in Congress.
Steve King, and that entire interview, we've posted a link to that on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. Another from that faction, Republican Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma, is opposed to raising the debt ceiling. And this week on the Senate floor, he tore up a symbolic credit card to make his point.
Wouldn't it be smart if we started addressing that problem before we blankly give an increase in the level of the credit card? Actually, what we should do is we should cut this credit card up, which is what I'm going to do, because that's the way I vote. I think it's time we quit borrowing money. Actually, I think I'll just tear it up. It's time we quit borrowing money against the future of our kids. It's time we quit mortgaging their future. It's time we start taking responsibility for the actions of the federal government.
Okay, here we have two representatives of the part of the Congress. What do you make of that, Bruce Nesmith? These are representatives, the duly elected. They don't seem to swing with the other of the GOP.
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, in terms of, you know, will defaulting or will not reaching and going past the debt limit cause a crisis? I am not an economist, but the economists that I read are not sanguine about this. The only people that are sanguine about this are Representative King and Senator Burr from North Carolina and people like that who are Republicans. So I'm not sure if they have any economic research to stand on, the economists and the people like Christine Lagarde of the IMF, the people in international economics, seem pretty petrified that this might actually occur.
Bruce Nesmith of Coe College is with us. Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. It's Politics Day here on River to River. We want to hear from you. How worried are you? Are you worried about the partial government shutdown, the gridlock in Washington, the looming default on a $16.7 trillion U.S. debt looming, I guess that's just next week. Share your thoughts. 1-866-780-9100. Your questions. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with more Politics Day. Stefan Schmidt and Bruce Nesmith in just a moment. And we're back with a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University, Bruce Nesmith of Coe College, our political scientists this week, as we talk about the stalemate over the government shutdown, the partial shutdown grinding into its ninth day, also the looming default on the U.S. debt due next week. October 17th is the date that we've been given, and we're asking, how worried are you about what's going on in Washington, the partial government shutdown, the possible default on this huge U.S. debt? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Let's If we could, Bruce and Stefan, go to some callers. Got a number of them. Greg in Des Moines. Hi. Welcome to our program.
Hi. Thank you. What I'm concerned about is that I'm worried that for a small faction of the Tea Party, that they really don't want anything. They're not negotiating to get anything. What they want is a shutdown, and they want us to default on our debts. Because what they think is that if we have a smaller government, if we have a government that's shut down and people don't notice or they don't enjoy a benefit from it, and that if suddenly it's really difficult to borrow a lot of money, then we can't borrow money, then we can they can win the argument that we can't afford entitlement payments to people and we can't afford to fight poverty or fight disease or fight terrorism, that we can't afford to do anything that costs money. And unfortunately, they're wrong. Half the furloughed workers are working for the Defense Department. That means they're working on things like protecting our children from terrorists.
Okay, Greg, let's get a reaction to that. Stefan Schmidt, a drastic form of starving the beast, I guess?
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, you look at, as I said before, you look at the statements by Tea Party conservative Republicans. They don't like the federal government. They have been talking about, and we saw that with Rick Perry during the caucus debates, you know, shut down three federal agencies, and he couldn't think of the third one. And then Ron Paul held up his fingers and said, no, five agencies, five. So there isn't any doubt that the end game for a lot of conservative Republicans is to shrink the federal government, and that this is a technique for doing that. The big problem is with the statement that we don't want to mortgage our children and grandchildren's future. We mortgage their future all the time when we buy a house and take out a mortgage. The federal government has never been able to operate successfully on the basis of, you know, cash in and cash out. The federal government has always borrowed money and issued bonds, and they repay those bonds, and those bonds are used to fix things, to protect us, and so on. And if the economy grows quickly enough, it's not a really big problem. The national debt is actually shrinking. And if we want to really stop the national debt from shrinking and the economy from malfunctioning, then let's go ahead and default on the debt and shut the government down, and you'll see what will happen to the economy. It'll be a very, very bad thing.
Let's go back to our phones, get a few more views. Donna in Ames, what's your view?
Well, I guess I have some concerns, too. I like to read people's comments to articles. And what I'm noticing is that a lot of the Tea Party Republicans don't believe that it's a problem if we go over the debt ceiling or if we don't raise it. I think they kind of take a view that, yeah, it might hurt for a while, but in the long run, it's the best thing for the country. So I guess I'm worried because I think they're pretty strong in their resolve to just stay the course and just let the country default. And I guess my side question on it is, what should people do with their money, you know, if they're going to prepare for a default or something like that?
I think we have political scientists here. I think you need to talk to your financial advisor, Donna. Thank you for your call from Ames. Jacqueline in Minnesota, calling from Minnesota. Jacqueline, listening to Iowa Public Radio. Welcome. What's your point?
Hi. I think that right now the nation is completely divided between Democrats and Republicans, which I think is the real problem, because a nation divided will not stand. And I think that it all just goes back to, you know, checks and balances, where Congress is checking the president, saying, you know, this health care plan that you have, you know, we should talk, let's talk about this. We don't, you know. And so I just think that, you know, Obama's not even going to negotiate with them.
Okay.
I don't think that's right. I think that, you know, we got to talk about it.
Jacqueline, thank you. Thank you for your comment from Minnesota, Jacqueline. 1-866-780-9100. Let me throw this comment to listeners to Morning Edition on Iowa Public Radio. May have heard this morning on NPR. Conservative Republican columnist George Will was asked whether the tactics being used by Republicans negotiating over the federal budget and the debt ceiling were new. He says they're not, and that Republicans are not subverting the system by asking for changes to existing law.
How does this short-circuit the system? I mean, I hear Democrats say, The Affordable Care Act is the law, as though we're supposed to genuflect at that sunburst of insight and move on. Well, the Fugitive Slave Act was the law. Separate but equal was the law. Lots of things are the law, and then we change them. And this is a part of the bruising, untidy, utterly democratic technique for changing laws.
George Will this morning, he went on to say that Republicans, though, are not in a winning position. He says a tactic is supposed to have, in his words, at least an articulable path to victory and success. And he doesn't see that path for Republicans in the current situation. I'm interested in your reaction, Stefan, to George Will. I'm feeling you may disagree with him.
Well, you can use any tactic that you want, and this is a tactic that no one has declared unconstitutional. It's just a bad idea because paralysis in government, and Steve King, by the way, is utterly wrong about the idea that, you know, basically not raising the debt ceiling has no consequences because we have plenty of money. In politics and in economics, perception and trust is everything. And the perception is that you cannot trust the United States. You shouldn't be buying American bonds because the system is broken and your money may go down the rat hole. And that's all it takes. It takes is perception. The Great Depression occurred not because the banks didn't have a lot of money and there was a ton of money around. It's because the perception was that your money was not safe in the banks and everyone ran downtown to the bank to get their money. And when that happened, there wasn't enough money. There was enough money under normal circumstances. You don't want a run on the bank of the debt of the United States because you'll get a contracting global economy, a collapsing demand structure, and the American economy will get very bad. And I'm keeping my money where it is to answer the lady. You know, I'm a political scientist, but we also study economics a lot. I'm not taking my money and, you know, buying gold bars with it because I think we will claw our way out of this. The stock market will recover and we will get back on a smoother glide path. But it is a dangerous game to be playing.
Okay. Bruce, let me ask you this because we had the recent callers there airing their opinions. I wonder if they are getting to something deeper than politics, reflecting a larger social divide in this country. Is this really a social divide in the country or a divide in our system of politics making itself apparent?
Well, I'm not sure if there's a difference. If the question is, is this people in Washington spitting at each other or are the people in Washington representing separate constituencies? I'd say definitely the second. There's a Pew Center for Research that asked people, now this is pre-shutdown, I think it was right on the eve of the shutdown, so about a week ago, and 75% of Democrats said, don't compromise with the Republicans. 77% of Republicans said, don't compromise with the Democrats. Mm-hmm. So this is what representatives are hearing. Our Democratic representatives are hearing from their constituents, hey, you know, don't give in like you did last time. And the Republican representatives are hearing from their constituents, Obamacare is awful. Whatever it takes, just, you know, within the law, do it and just help save us from Obamacare and spending and all that stuff. So, I mean, absolutely, I think the representatives are being faithful to the wishes of the people that elected them. The question that I have, and I think this is kind of what Stefan said earlier, is how do you get from that to an outcome? How do you get a decision out of that?
Do we need a very, very serious crisis to jar people out of their present positions?
Well,
such as what would come possibly after a default on the debt. I don't know.
Yeah.
Let's go to Mel in Des Moines, if we could. Bruce, West Des Moines, actually. Mel, hi.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to talk.
Sure.
The situation scares me. I'm an economics professor, and it scares me a lot. And the representatives that are saying certain things obviously do not have a good knowledge of economics, in my opinion, because anybody that knows that the amount of money that's coming into the government is not enough to pay their bills, that's why the debt ceiling has to increase. And also on top of that, you have the closure which is laying off a lot of other people. So the chances of these government people, if the shutdown continues, being able to spend money, they won't have disposable income, which is what allows the economy to grow. 70% of the economy is based upon consumption. And if these people aren't going to be able to consume because they're out of a job at least, or laid off for a period of time, the economy is going to go right into the dumper again. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, again, the implication seems to be from these Republicans that the debt ceiling is done because we need to buy more things. What people have to understand is the increase in the debt ceiling has nothing to buying new things. It's paying the bills of things that they've already done. And so I agree with your both of your professors here that especially the person who spoke before this previously about him not taking his money out of the bank. I agree with him greatly. There's just going to be a lot of problems, and the Republicans seem to be in a situation that they don't understand it. That's the biggest problem. Secondly, I agree with your second professor that one of the problems that we have is 77%, he said, of the Republicans say don't compromise, and 75% of the Democrats say don't compromise. We have this gerrymandering crap that allows certain people to have safe, very safe aspects of range of populations. Yep. So if they're that safe, they don't have to compromise because they don't have that kind of competitive situation where a person, if they do something that...
But Mel, people, Iowa, we don't have gerrymandered districts. We have a special nonpartisan committee that gets those. And we have a Tea Party member in our Congress in the 4th District, don't we?
Yeah, but we're not the only state in the union that does that.
Okay, we're coming to the end of our hour. Let's talk about a possible way out here yesterday. Reading today, NBC reporting that yesterday Republicans began floating proposals that had nothing to do with health care. And this is news. The Wall Street Journal op-ed piece said that House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan argued for both sides to agree to common sense reforms for the country's entitlement programs and tax code. He called for some of the very things that President Obama and the Democrats have already put on the table. Most important, as this report pointed out, Paul Ryan did not mention in the op-ed any changes to the president's health care law. Is that, Stefan, perhaps an olive branch, a way out, a grand bargain?
It's an olive branch, but the problem is those things also have to be negotiated. And in the meantime, the government is shut down. The government isn't operating. And it's no skin off of Obama or the Democrats' teeth to have the government shut down. It's skinning all of our knees and ankles and legs. And so it's essentially brutalizing the country. So if Ryan wants to negotiate all of those complicated things while the country is now shut down or the government is partially shut down, that, you know, that's still a lot of pain that's being imposed. But yes, I guess if the Democrats can agree to a couple of things to give the Republicans who are not wanting to pass the continuing resolution a face-saving way of voting to continue spending, anything that you can bring up is better than nothing. But it's still using the continuing resolution essentially as the hostage to negotiate things that ought to be done during the normal legislative process, which, you know, exists, and that's where you pass all these reforms, which the Republicans in the past also didn't want to engage in. I mean, it's not as if these things didn't come up before the end of this budget, and they didn't want to talk about them. They didn't want to do immigration reform. They didn't want to pass, you know, the farm bill and so on. So it's odd. It's a desperate move, but I guess it's better than nothing.
To speak to that point just a second, Ben, is that we desperately need in this country, we desperately need entitlement reform, and I desperately want entitlement reform to occur. I don't want entitlement reform that occurs in a week. And the other thing is that Paul Ryan today has, there's an article in Politico, he has denied that he has left Obamacare off the table, that he, for him it's very much still on the table. So there's some question about that olive branch.
Okay, quickly, before we have to go, gentlemen, your comment on this, because this week the U.S. Supreme Court re-entered the debate over money and politics. It heard arguments in a case that could further erode limits on campaign cash. Now, we remember 3 years ago, it was a narrow 5-4 conservative majority that ruled that corporations are people. They are entitled to spend unlimited amounts on candidates' elections as long as they do it separately from candidates' campaigns. Well, on Tuesday of this week, the court moved to grapple with direct contributions to campaigns, in particular the aggregate limits on contributions by wealthy donors. Sean McCutcheon, a conservative Alabama businessman, brought the suit to challenge the aggregate limits on his donations to individual candidates. Here he is.
I think this is a fundamental free speech issue about your right to spend your money on as many candidates as you choose. It doesn't make any sense that if, say, my 18th race was Alabama House race and then also wanted to donate to a Florida Senate race, that I couldn't do that.
And Fred Wertheimer, he's an attorney who's been involved in writing nearly every campaign finance reform bill since 1974, says the aggregate limits protect against wealthy donors having undue influence. He says without aggregate limits, joint fundraising committees like the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee or the National Republican Senatorial Committee could see contributions in the millions.
The Speaker of the House or the Democratic leader of the House could go to Mr. McCutcheon and ask him for a check for well over $2 million. And it is that relationship, that $2 million solicited by a powerful office holder and given by a donor, that creates the corruption relationship that the court says Congress can prohibit.
Okay. Bruce Nesmith, what do you see at stake in the latest case that the Supreme Court has taken up here?
Well, I think what's at stake is our ability to discuss and negotiate public problems. If we decide that something is a fundamental right and therefore off the table, not to diss free speech, but that means that we just can't talk about that entire issue.
Explain a little bit more what you mean.
Exactly this. I mean, there may or may not, there are stakes in this argument between people's ability to participate and the ability of elections, the ability of the public not to have unbalanced, distorted elections mm-hmm. that are dominated by a few large donors.
So, Stefan Schmidt, is it really a question of, okay, everybody's got free speech, but some people have tiny little megaphones to spread their message, and others have huge football field-sized megaphones that go 24/7.
So what else is new? It's always been that way in one form or another. There is no campaign finance reform. There never has been. Every campaign finance reform has had loopholes big enough to drive a tank through. And Mr. McCutcheon, you know, is a whiner because he can take his millions and set up a super PAC, give his money secretly to that political action committee, and they can go out and spend like drunken sailors on whoever he wants. And then he can tell people, hey, guys, you know, that money from that secret super PAC, you know, I gave a whole lot of that money. This is just the Supreme Court is going to rule in his favor. They've said that corporations are people. Well, people are people. And this is what he's demanding is if corporations can pour all this money, then let me do it as well. Wertheimer is a sad figure because he's been fighting for campaign finance reform forever and hasn't gotten anything. There is nothing like that. So let's spend as much money as we can and buy as many politicians as possible because that's the reality.
Okay. Well, quickly, before we have to go, last week, Senator Kent Sorensen, former senator now, Republican of Milo, vacated his seat in the wake of a report on his activities during the 2012 caucus campaign. Bruce, any significant fallout from that, do you think?
I think the Republicans acted to minimize that fallout by essentially giving him the push.
Okay. And Stefan Schmidt, lasting damage, for instance, to the reputation of the Iowa caucuses, or was that stemmed with this action?
Everything that goes wrong politically in Iowa puts a stain on the idea that Iowa is squeaky clean and that we do politics on top of the table, and it hurts a little bit. We've got to stop doing things like that. We've got to get the caucus reporting system fixed so that the count on caucus night is more accurate. Otherwise, we're going to lose the caucuses at some point, but I don't think this is, you know, a shot to the head.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, each of you have 10 or 15 seconds to tell me the most likely scenario that we get out of the current standoff in Washington. Stefan, do you want to go first? Quickly.
I think we're going to scramble out of it at some point, but it's going to do a lot of damage, and we're not going to make much progress in the policy areas.
Bruce Nesmith.
We'd find a formula that Republicans can agree to that Obama says is not a capitulation, and on we go.
Okay. We'll leave it there. Sure to be continued next week and in the following weeks. Bruce Nesmith is the Jonan Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coe College. Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Stefan, Bruce, always great to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
And tomorrow on this program, when Henrietta Lacks died, 1951, her family had no idea that her cells would live on indefinitely, multiplying to the extent that if they were laid together, these are human cells, they would wrap around the earth at least three times. Tomorrow, the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks. I'll talk with Lacks' grandson about her legacy and with researchers who have worked with the cells that led to medical breakthroughs, cancer cures, treatments for HIV, Parkinson's, others, the polio vaccine, tomorrow on this program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Help today from Garrett Van Leeuwen in Ames, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.